Hi, this is Christopher O'Reilly, host of From the Top. Thank you for tuning into this week's podcast. While this podcast is free for all of you, it actually costs our little nonprofit some significant resources to purchase rights for all this fabulous music. Please consider making a small gift to From the Top and keep us broadcasting loud and clear. Go to fromthetop.org and click on Support.
Hair has always been a big deal in classical music. You know, long hair music. Antonio Vivaldi, Nigel Kennedy. Well, today you'll meet a teenage percussionist with such curly hair that a sparrow once built a nest in it. From NPR, it's From the Top, celebrating the power of music in the hands of America's kids. We're at the Gene B. McCoy Community Center for the Arts in New Albany, Ohio, where we'll also hear a 16-year-old cellist perform the fanciful Capriccio by Lucas Foss. From the Top's home is New England Conservatory, where outstanding young artists and inspirational teachers are transforming classical music. Here's our host, the great concert pianist, Christopher O'Reilly.
Thank you. Thank you and welcome. We want to thank the McCoy Center for bringing us back to New Albany, just northeast of Columbus, Ohio. New Albany is a very pretty and welcoming little city with lovely homes, white picket fences, and the feel of 18th century America, and a progressive commitment to education and culture so great that this art center is a part of the public school system. Actually, the entire Columbus area is a hotbed of young classical musicians. If you've listened to our show for a few years, you might have noticed that we featured an inordinate number of kids from Columbus and its surrounding communities. And we're going to feature three local kids on today's show. Our first young performer is from just next door in Worthington, Ohio. Please welcome 17-year-old flutist Audrey Watkins. Audrey, welcome. Tell everyone what we're going to play.
We're going to be playing the third movement of Poulenc's Sonata for Flute and Piano, entitled Presto Giocoso.
When you are set, we will take it from the top. Thank you. Audrey Watkins, 17-year-old flutist from nearby Worthington, Ohio, performing the third movement of the Sonata for Flute and Piano by Francis Poulenc. Audrey, congratulations. You really bring to light all the schizophrenic changes of scene and character in that brief and ebullient movement. Just love playing that with you.
Thank you.
Audrey, you're from this area, but you're going to school where?
At Interlochen Arts Academy in Interlochen, Michigan.
You liking it?
I do. I love it.
Who you're studying with there?
I study with Nancy Stagnita.
So you're at this great arts school preparing for auditions for college, I know, but you say that you've learned to take the pressure in stride. You really make an effort to keep yourself sort of holistically healthy in
yeah.
midst of all that stress.
I don't like to practice too much. I actually really like to take time, especially in like the most stressful times when you're preparing for auditions. I really think that's the most important time for me personally, to take time to just sort of, you know, go to the gym, go to the cafeteria and eat something really healthy, you know, really take some time to just tune into your body and kind of go out into the woods and experience life a little bit, because I find that when I come to perform, after having done that, I'm really able to bring a lot to a performance where otherwise I would be.
And you do have an appreciation of the great outdoors. I know the fact that you're kind of a farm girl,
yeah.
I guess, gives you some perspective on that. Do you think that's contributive?
You know, I'm not really too keen on the farm life. Farmers have a big appreciation for varieties of poop, and I don't. So I'm not really too into that stuff.
So you're okay. We're not going to leave you down on the farm anymore.
No, okay. I don't think so.
You have some really good memories, though, of growing up on the farm. Tell the pig story, the 4-H pig story.
Okay. Well, for 4-H, you know, you raise pigs. For me, I raised them, you know, on my dad's farm. And then you take them to the fair, and you do showmanship. And then at the end of the fair week, you sell your pigs. And it's kind of hard to get, like, a good price at the fair for pigs because, you know, some people will pay for, like, really fancy pigs, and then they get a lot of extra money. So the best technique is just to look really cute and be like, okay, you know, put in your pigtails and, like, you know, your whole thing. And then, like, the guy who's selling them will be like, oh, come on, look at the cute girl, look at the cute girl. Like, let's drive the price up. yeah, so, you know, I sold my pigs my first year for $1.75, and then $1.75 a pound. And then my sisters were like, okay, I feel really lazy and my sister's doing well at selling these, so Audrey, would you please sell my pigs for me? So I ended up selling my sister's pigs as well, but it was a lucrative day for the entire family.
I
so
know.
It's really fine.
And thank goodness for the pigtails.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, it's a little unstable there. I mean, you're trying to do a good presentation and there the pigs are running you over most of the time.
Yeah, they're, you know, when I started this when I was about 9, and the pigs are maybe like, I don't know, 200 pounds, I think, is the weight limit. So sometimes you wind up where they'll run into you and knock you over, or even worse, where they'll run between your legs and then you're kind of riding the pig around the arena, which is not good. So, yeah. It
sort of a hog sale slash rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
You should get paid extra for that, I
yeah.
think. Audrey, great playing on the Poulenc, and great to have you with us.
It's been awesome to be on the show.
Thanks, Audrey.
Thanks.
All the best. Audrey Watkins, 17-year-old flutist from nearby Worthington, Ohio. Our next performer is a fantastic 17-year-old percussionist from Chicago, Illinois. His name is Eric Goldberg. Eric, you'll be playing the marimba we've just wheeled into place. Tell us about this piece.
Yes, the piece I'll be playing tonight is called Scirocco by Michael Burritt. The word Scirocco means hot desert wind, and this image is captured in the piece by the swirling movements of the melodic lines. And also, it's a very fast piece. There's a lot of notes in a very short period of time, so it creates for a sort of chaotic atmosphere.
Thank you.
Eric Goldberg, 17-year-old percussionist from Chicago, performing Scirocco by Michael Burrett. Eric is a student in the Chicago Symphony's Percussion Scholarship Group. Some pretty sweet changes in that piece there, Eric. Gosh, I love the harmonies, and I love the flurry of activity that you seem to have such an ease with. And also the overtones that you get out of the marimba that totally rival the piano, just mm-hmm. in terms of the sumptuousness and the wooden quality of the earthy quality of the sound. Just a great performance.
Thank you.
Eric, you've done quite a bit of theater growing up, and you're, of course, a natural performer and storyteller. So we're going to provide you with a couple of different sound environments to help you tell some of your stories. Ready?
Okay.
It's not that easy being green. Having to spend each day the color of the leaves. When I think it could be nicer.
Kermit the Frog tells us that it's not easy being green. You can relate to this song, can't you?
Yes. Well, I guess as I've grown older, I've been sort of more aware of the fact that I often confuse people. You know, being mixed race, I'm half black, half white. You know, people sort of look at me and play this guessing game of what my ethnicity might be. And also, living in a household with two religions, you know, I have the last name Goldberg, which is very Jewish. And then I tell people I'm a confirmed Catholic, and that confuses them. So, you know, I'm very proud to have all these backgrounds as a part of me, but it also is very frustrating sometimes because, you know, people often try to categorize me or put me into a box and try to limit me to one of these backgrounds, but I want to be regarded as all of them. So, you know, for example, I have friends who say stuff like, oh, there are no black kids in the room. Oh, wait, there's Eric, but he's not really black. And that drives me crazy because it's like, what makes you think you can dictate, like, what I am and what I'm not? Like, that's not something you can take away from me, and that I've come to a point where I'm very confident. I'm able to say, like, you know, like, you don't have the power to say that, and I'm able to sort of assert that and, you know, like, let people know who I am and, like, how I want to be seen.
Good for you, Eric, really. You know, your multifaceted identity isn't the only attractive thing about you. Your hair, which I've seen before, is also quite attractive, and I mean to flora and fauna alike, as it happens. Go ahead, Eric. That's a cue.
Yes, well, one of the best perks of being multiracial is having sort of interesting curly hair. I call it my Afro-Jufro hybrid. I have worn it at many different lengths before. How you see me today is sort of the shortest I've ever kept it. But the tallest I've ever had it, I thought it was gross.
It was, like, not gross. It was twice as tall as you were at the time. I know that, though.
No, like, I have friends who are like, Eric, bring the Afro back. And I look at pictures, and I'm like, who let me do that to myself? Like, oh, my gosh. No, so one story I have to sort of show how big it really was three summers ago one time, me and a few friends were just hanging out in the park. And I guess a sparrow from a nearby tree spotted my hair and thought it could be a comfortable home. So it just sort of flew in there, and it took me a minute to realize it. A friend had to say, Eric, there's a bird in your hair. And
not an urban legend, in other
no,
words.
No, it really happened. And I didn't move, partially because I was scared, partially because I thought, you know, if I moved an inch, it would, like, peck my brains out or something. So I kind of just let it sat there. It stayed there for a good 20 minutes. It left some grass and made a comfortable little spot for itself. And, you know, I was very honored that it saw my hair as a suitable place to live. So.
I know the birds aren't the only admiring parties. I know people come up to you on the bus and say, well, what do you use in your hair? So, I mean, we have to know, Eric.
Well, I actually don't use any kind of product or anything. Sometimes use, like, a curling thing, but mostly I just condition my hair and then wash it. Sometimes when I used to use shampoo, you know, I wasn't very particular about what shampoo I used, so I just used what was in the house. So my sisters and my mom used the shampoo for women of color, which I used for a long time, and you know, that actually worked very well for me. So
here's a sound from your hoped-for future. Wow, they love that. Where are you in your imagination there?
Here I am performing for a crowd of people who are very excited to be there and who love classical music. And I really hope that's something that continues. I think it should, but part of me is very afraid that it won't. You know, me and other kids who love classical music, I'm sure they would agree with me. We go to orchestra concerts and we think, where are the young people? Like, it's very concerning, just like looking at, like, the music that the people age listen to, and like, it's like, classical music is great too. Like, why won't you listen to it? So I guess the reason I work so hard at what I do, not only because I love my instrument, but because I want to play a part in keeping classical music alive, like whatever I can do. I've thought, like, other things that can be done to sort of, like, pique the interest. Like, for example, I've really been into combining technology and classical music. There's many composers who write pieces like this and ensembles who specialize in that, so that's something I love to tap into. But basically, anything I could do to keep it alive, because it's really a beautiful thing, and I want everyone to realize that forever and ever. So,
well, Eric, we certainly appreciate your crusading efforts and as well as your virtuosity. We are casting our vote in favor of a positive future for Eric Goldberg.
Thank you.
You've also won one of our Jack Kent Cook Young Artist Awards, so congratulations there.
Thank you.
All the best to you, Eric. Thanks for being with us. Eric Goldberg, 17-year-old percussionist from Chicago, Illinois.
Eric is already working to expand the audience for classical music. This morning, he and three of today's other performers went with us into a high school to share their music with students there. Did you know From the Top does education outreach like this all over the country? You can learn more at fromthetop.org. From the Top is made possible in part by the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, advancing the education of students of exceptional promise who have financial need. On the web at jkcf.org. Chris.
Thanks, Joanne. The American mezzo-soprano Frederica von Stade has been one of the most beloved singers in the world for over 30 years. She's performed in pretty much every major opera house in the world, singing roles as diverse as Cherubino in The Marriage of Figaro to the unforgettable Mrs. De Roker, the mother of the death row inmate in Dead Man Walking. She's now retired to California, where she contributes much to the Bay Area community. I spoke to Ms. von Stade, or Flicka, earlier. Flicka, so many of the teenage singers on our program love your recordings, of course, and admire your career, but when you were a teenager, you probably wouldn't have been on our show. You were kind of a late bloomer when it came to classical singing, yes?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was doing off-Broadway at that point, and as far off-Broadway as New Haven, Connecticut. I knew nothing about opera, and I was actually at 18 on my way to live in Paris for a year to quote-unquote study, which most of the time I did not do, but had learned an enormous amount just from living in Paris. And that was the first time I ever went to an opera, which was Carmen in a not great production. But it's also the first time I heard a great recital, and it was Elisabeth Schwarzkopf at the Théâtre Champs-Élysées, and I didn't understand anything that she was singing because it was mainly in German, but I was absolutely captivated, as one would be.
Flicka, do you have any advice, rules about practicing you'd like to pass on to some of our young singers?
The piece of advice is based on a painting that was always by the piano of a great teacher that I worked with named Jani Strasse, who is Hungarian. And it was a picture of some poodles, three poodles who were sort of sitting up. And I said, Jani, why do you have that picture there? And he said, my darling, those pictures are your poodles, and your voice is your poodles. If you are good to your poodles, they do tricks. If you are bad to your poodles, they bite you. And it's really true. You have to be good to your voice, and you have to be good to your mind. Singers tend to really be very harsh with themselves. It's not a perfect instrument. To expect it to perform perfectly is never going to happen. But definitely be good to your poodles.
That's gold. That's absolute gold. Flicka, would you please do us the honor of introducing our next young performers?
I would be delighted to introduce your performers and just wish that I could hear them, and I send them all my best wishes and support. Now to perform Geistliches Wiegenlied by Johannes Brahms, please welcome, from just outside Columbus, Ohio, the members of the Mittelpunkt Duo. They are 18-year-old violist Eva Kennedy and my fellow mezzo-soprano, 17-year-old Michaela Cipriani.
Michaela, I have to ask you, what is it like being introduced by Friederike von Stade?
It's completely amazing. I look up to her so much. When I found out that she was going to be introducing us on Monday, I actually started crying. The recording of her singing Cherubino was actually what inspired me to start singing classical music, and so this is just crazy.
It's a great coming together of wonderful energies. For those of you who might be interested, and I think you ought to be, we had a wonderfully long conversation, and the entirety of my interview with Friederike von Stade is available on our website, fromthetop.org. Now, this beautiful piece that Eva and you have brought, Michaela, requires piano, so happily, I'll be joining you. Will you please set the scene and tell us a bit about the text of this song?
Yeah, the text is a poem, and the speaker is Mary, and she is trying to get the baby Jesus to fall asleep, but there's a storm going on, and the wind is really cold, and it's kind of harsh, and then she's trying to get the angels to help her quiet down the treetops so that baby Jesus can go to sleep, and then eventually everything kind of settles down, and the piece becomes a really sweet kind of lullaby.
Thank you.
The Mittelpunkt Duo, and yours truly performing Geistliche Gegenlied by Johannes Brahms from two songs for alto, viola, and piano. Our mezzo-soprano, Michael Cipriani, 17, and our violist, Eva Kennedy, 18. They're both from the Columbus area and study at the Chamber Music Connection with Debbie Price. That was really extraordinary, you guys. I mean, I think it's just such a special musical moment, you know, this... without accompaniment, without even the voice to begin, we hear this lullaby, solo viola, and then we all kind of wander in as if we were having overheard thoughts and memories of this tumult, you know, surrounding the baby Jesus' birth and his fragile life. It's such just a gorgeous piece. I'm so glad we got to do it all together. A beautiful performance, both of you.
Thank you.
Eva's been on our show playing chamber music before. It's great to have you back, Eva. Eva, I know that this is your first time working with a singer. So how did things work differently for you?
Yeah, this is my first time playing with a vocalist, and it has been really, really different. I've been playing with string players for a long time, but obviously with a vocalist it's different because you can't see, there's no bow to watch or anything. So learning to sort of match her articulation and match her phrasing was really difficult at first, but it's actually been really, it's been really fun, and it's been really beneficial as well to my solo playing, because as a string player, all I'm ever told is to play more like a vocalist, phrase like a vocalist, do everything like a vocalist. So this experience has been really valuable.
And Brahms actually gives you a leg up. He actually prints the lyrics under your opening solo. So there you have the words to play on the viola. And Michaela, what have you liked in particular about working with Eva in this piece?
I think working with instrumentals and working with Eva in particular has been really interesting for me because I kind of have to get out of the singer box of thinking about interpreting music as interpreting poetry and thinking about a piece as like a dramatic monologue, because instrumentals don't have the poetry to go by, and so it became more about analyzing the structure of the music and looking at the sorts of effects we could put into it, and it was just like a very different way of thinking about it that I had never experienced before.
Yeah, the structure, the architecture, yeah, that comes comes across, really, really does. So you've learned a lot from each other and become a real duo, but you stick together for another reason. Isn't there some solidarity between you, Eva?
There's absolutely some solidarity, because both violists and singers are often the butt of a lot of jokes in the music world.
Jokes about violists?
I can't go anywhere without hearing viola jokes.
No.
Or so singer jokes.
Michaela and I know that we play the best instruments, so as long as we band together, we can take anybody down.
Absolutely. There's so much to be proud of and to enjoy in your musical roles with larger ensembles. I mean, you named your partnership the Mittelpunkt Duo to emphasize that. What, Michaela, what does Mittelpunkt mean for everybody?
Mittelpunkt means midpoint. So we chose that because we're the middle voices. And the middle voices usually play like supporting roles, which is cool. Like, we really like doing that. But like, Mittelpunkt also kind of has the connotation of focal point or like central point. And so in this piece, we get to be the stars, and like nobody else that makes jokes gets to participate. Like, no violinists, no sopranos. It's awesome.
That's right. It also has punked in the title,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is also
it
cool.
It has the word punk in it. Yeah. So like, how could you go wrong?
I know. Well, let's revel in the joys of the middle and lower lines in music for a bit longer. To do so, we've developed a little quiz. Michaela, we'll have you go first. We're going to play you a clip from an ensemble passage from a famous opera. But this custom-made sound clip features the mezzo-soprano line only, No other pesky, annoying voices involved. The trick is, can you name the opera just by hearing the mezzo line? Now, we're not heartless, so we've chosen a passage from an opera that you'll be familiar with. Joanne, go ahead.
Okay, you ready, Michaela?
Yep.
Here we go.
Es ist was kommen und ist was geschehen. Ich muss sie fragen.
Ah, makes you never want to sing the melody again. Is that A, Octavian's part from the final trio in Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier? B, Maddalena's part in the magnificent quartet from Verdi's Rigoletto? Or C, Michelle Williams' part in Destiny's Child's global hit, Bootylicious?
It's the Rosenkavalier.
Excellent. Yes, absolutely. Let's hear the mezzo-soprano line in context.
Okay, Eva, it's your turn now. From one of the best-known pieces of chamber music, listen to this viola line and identify the piece. Is that from A, the first movement of Haydn's String Quartet, Opus 64, number 3? B, John Cage's Fads and Fancies in the Academy, originally for Metal Waste Basket. C, Tchaikovsky's String Sextet in D minor, Souvenir de Florence, Opus 70. Or D, the first movement of the String Quartet No. 2 in A minor by Johannes Brahms.
I'm sort of feeling the Cage, but I think I'm going to go with the Brahms.
Excellent choice. Yes, the first movement from the String Quartet No. 2 in A minor by Johannes Brahms. Let's hear all the parts. Well, one thing is absolutely certain. We love those mezzo and viola parts, never more so than today. Thank you, and bravo to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on the show.
The Mythic Pink Duo, Michaela Cipriani, 17-year-old mezzo-soprano, and Eva Kennedy, 18 years old, a violist, both from here in the Columbus area.
Being in the audience for a From the Top taping is an unforgettable experience. We tape shows all over the country, and this June we'll be coming to the Lone Star State to tape shows in El Paso and San Marcos. For tickets and information, go to fromthetop.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from U.S. Trust, believing that the arts have a worth all their own in stimulating the hearts and imaginations of our country's best young musicians. From the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture, poetryfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Thank you.
From NPR, it's From the Top, celebrating the power of music in the hands of America's kids. This week, we're coming to you from the Jean B. McCoy Community Center for the Arts in New Albany, Ohio. Coming up, speaking of Rigoletto, we'll hear the concert paraphrase on Rigoletto by Franz Liszt, performed by a pianist who's just 13 years old. From the Top's home is New England Conservatory, where outstanding young artists and inspirational teachers are transforming classical music. Today's show in New Albany is made possible with support from Fifth Third Bank. Special thanks to WOSU Public Media, Classical 101 FM, and City Scene Magazine. Here again is Christopher O'Reilly.
Thanks, Joanne. Next, an outstanding cellist from another Midwestern town with a host of young classical musicians, especially string players. From Bloomington, Indiana, this is 16-year-old Sung Moon Park. You also go by an English name, yes?
Yeah, I go by Brian Park, actually.
Brian, okay. Well, there's a funny story behind that name, and we're going to get to that in a moment. But first, let's play this fun-loving piece. Tell everyone what it is.
I'm going to be playing Capriccio by Lucas Foss. I hope you enjoy.
Thank you. Sung Moon Park, 16-year-old cellist from Bloomington, Indiana, performing Capriccio by Lucas Foss. Thank you for displaying all the dry wit available in that piece, Brian, or Sung Moon. Wonderful, and very witty and understated performance. Really nicely done. Okay, so Sung Moon, we know you go by Brian. Spill the beans. I sense a funny story about your choice of an English name here.
So when I first came to America, I was in fourth grade, and I knew completely no English at all. And Brian was the only name I knew. And so I chose that. And it was actually, I think it was a name of a Korean celebrity or something, but I don't remember. Yeah.
That's so random, Brian. I mean, have you ever thought about other names you might have chosen if only you'd known they'd existed?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, so let's try out a few other names as we talk. Okay, so Brian, Bian, Bobo. Oh, I'm sorry, we won't go through that. Brian, what's another name you might have chosen?
Why don't we go with Jose?
Jose. for a Korean, I think that's. Well, sure. You've got kimchi and you've got hot sauce. I think that might work. Well, let's go with it. Okay, Jose. Yeah. Jose, can you see? I'm sorry. No, it's all right. No. Well, tell me, Jose, you're the only musician in your family, I understand, and I guess that leads to a fair amount of joking around.
Yes. My dad is a mechanical engineering professor, and my mom's a graduate student, and my grandfather was a physics professor, and my brother's a mechanical engineering student, and the list just goes on. And because I'm the only musical, the musical member of the family, they actually call me the Mutation because I'm the only one that plays music.
I guess better than the Walking Dead, I suppose, but yeah. Mutation, that's kind of warm and fuzzy. I'm not sure if Jose is working right now. You've got another name that you like?
How about Bob?
Bob, we like Bob. Bob's good. Okay, let's try that one on. Bob, you had a great summer last year. Where did you go?
I went to the Heifetz International Music Institute last year.
We've taken our show there a couple of times. For a music camp, they do something really interesting, a specific class that you do there. Talk about that, will you, Bob?
Yeah, they have this program called the Communication Training Class, and basically you learn about singing, public speech, drama, dancing. I mean, we didn't really dance. It was just kind of like trying to dance. But we also learned about freedom of expression. And I was kind of like, is this really going to help me? But then after the program, it helped me so much. Like, I could connect to the audience so much more. And I could just feel so much more comfortable on stage.
Clearly, it's paid off. I like the way you welcomed the audience into your performance and hoping that they enjoyed it, et cetera. That was great. I don't know, though. I think we might want to stick with Brian. I like Brian for you.
I don't know. I kind of like Jose.
Jose's. It got
I,
the
I
laughs.
I like to confuse people.
If it gets the laughs, we'll go with Jose. Thank you, Jose. It works for me.
Thank you so
for being
much.
With us. Brian Park, 16-year-old cellist from Bloomington, Indiana.
Podcasts of From the Top are available every week at fromthetop.org. Over the last 5 years, From the Top and the Jack Kent Cook Foundation have awarded well over $1 million in scholarships to talented young musicians who have financial need. We still have more to give. Go to fromthetop.org to learn more. Chris.
We've got another Jack Kent Cook young artist to take us out of the program today, a fine 13-year-old pianist from California named Eden Chen. Eden, welcome. From what California town are you from?
Los Angeles.
I've heard of that one. And you've a big, wonderful extended family all pretty much living in the same community. Give us the rundown of who lives nearby.
I've got two uncles, two aunts, my grandparents, two cousins, my mom, dad, and sister.
And I guess your uncle is in business with your dad, so it's all very tight-knit. Must be pretty crazy. Do you get together for meals often?
Yeah. We go out to eat together every Friday, so I get to see my family, and so my grandparents always try to pile as much food as they can on my plate.
So how does your dad feel about your ambitions in music?
My parents are both very supportive, because they both flew here with me. And my dad has a background in IT, so like he's always telling me to do business or like computers or something.
Well, you're doing key punch, so I mean it's sort of in the same world. Well, you play wonderfully, and I think you should stick with your guns with music for as long as possible. Would you please introduce the piece you're going to finish the concert with?
I am going to perform the Rigoletto paraphrase by Liszt. It was originally an opera by Verdi, and Liszt transcribed it over to piano.
Very good. A fiery way to end our show. I want to thank all of our young performers, and thank you all for listening. This is Christopher O'Reilly. Please join me next week. And now, Eden, you can take it from the top. Thank you.
From the Top is written and produced by Tom Vagley and Tim Banker, with music producer Tom Vinieri. The tour producer is David Balsam, and the production manager is Elizabeth DeVore. Technical direction by Barrett Ouellette, with David Forbes and John Servies. The executive producers are Gerald Slavitt and Jennifer Hurley-Wales. I'm Joanne Robinson. Thanks to Otterbein University and Rich Bradburn for providing the marimba for today's program, and also to violist Jisun Hong and mezzo-soprano Jillian Cotter for helping us out with our quiz. From the Top is an independent nonprofit organization based in Boston.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Flicka, so many of the teenage singers on our program love your recordings, of course, and admire your career. But when you were a teenager, you probably wouldn't have been on our show. You were kind of a late bloomer when it came to classical singing, yes?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was doing off-Broadway at that point, and as far off-Broadway as New Haven, Connecticut. I loved everything about Broadway and I knew nothing about opera. And I was actually at 18 on my way to live in Paris for a year to quote-unquote study, which most of the time I did not do, but had learned an enormous amount just from living in Paris. Mm-hmm. I was a nanny. I was a sales girl. I was a maid. And I did go to school from time to time and actually heard my first opera ever in Paris, which was Carmen in a not great production. But it's also the first time I heard a great recital, and it was Elisabeth Schwarzkopf at the Théâtre Champs-Élysées, and I didn't understand anything that she was singing because it was mainly in German, but I was absolutely captivated, as one would be.
There was another real light bulb moment when you were a kid, one person in particular who made a significant impact on your musical development.
Well, I went to Sacred Heart School in Noroton, Connecticut, and we had a French teacher who was French, which is, you know, pretty unusual many times. And she made us do everything in French. She never spoke a word of English. And because we read so extensively in French, and she said, please just don't worry if you understand it, just read it. You will start to get it. And she thought it would be helpful to me to start to listen to some French music. And that's, I think, when I fell in love with it, especially the music of Poulenc, because it was sort of café concert, and it was very easy to understand, and it was very accessible. Mm-hmm. So that was another kind of spur in the desire to get out there and sing.
It's a beautiful connection, and I know how demanding she was. I think you were reading. You were asked to read about 200 pages a day, or no, a week or something.
It was at least 50 pages a night, and it was Lamartine and Saint-Exupéry, and she was right. If you actually read it and don't worry about understanding every word, you get enough from what you do know, and she was a very good teacher, so we knew quite a lot. Mm-hmm. You can start to get the sense and the rhythm of the language, and when I actually arrived in Paris, I was a little, you know, flabbergasted by the speed of how everybody spoke. But it was, in 10 days, I was getting pretty comfortable in speaking French. And that's a sign of a great teacher.
Absolutely. So you made your premiere at the Met just a few years after you began studying classical music seriously. What do you remember about being thrust into the spotlight with so little experience? I mean, for instance, when was the first moment, for instance, that I know you were taking voice lessons in New York, and what was the moment when somebody said, well, gosh, you really ought to audition for something?
Well, in that time, there were the Met auditions, and they were many, many rounds. It was at least eight before you got anywhere near the Metropolitan Opera House. And I never... thought that I would get anywhere. I just didn't have an expectation. It was my teacher, who I adored and will always adore, Sebastian Engelberg, who said, I think you should do it. But, you know, what can you lose? And so I did it. And then as we got closer to the semifinals, I got sort of more nervous and excited. And when I was asked to come and sing in the semifinals, I mean, I was over the moon. But I still was so innocent, maybe not innocent, but naive about what went into opera and what it was about, that I don't think I had the wherewithal to be that frightened. It was just like this amazing adventure. And I learned my aria, and it was lots of fun being at the Met. There was a marvelous woman named Pater Gimber who looked after all the young artists, and we were 25 or 30, and we had this big, you know, we sang at the Met and with piano, and I remember walking across the back of the stage, and everybody sounded marvelous, and I started to get nervous, but I went out there, and it was like a total revelation and surprise that I actually, you know, won a place in it, and then I was thrilled, and it's been very much that way altogether, just... Mm-hmm. I didn't know enough to set my sights on it, so that when it happened, it was like Christmas. And then I went back and sang in the finals, and by then I had a contract, because quite honestly, it was the time of the Met's lockout, and I think they were desperate. They needed some singers, and I was lucky enough to get a contract and started singing... Oh, everybody's younger brother or maid. That's why it had been so useful to have been in Paris.
Right. And that method acting came in very, very handy.
I doubt
you never
know.
That,
you never know.
I doubt very much that the Met was desperate in any way in thinking of you and hearing you for the first time. But it does sound to me like your preparation for the audition stood you in good stead in your early experiences. It sounded like you were paying attention and learning the roles and just doing the work and not really worrying so much about, well, I don't know, you tell me. I mean, was it really the work ethic? I suppose you really weren't worried about other, you know, what other people would think. I know that you have an incredible reputation. You get along with absolutely everybody you work with. And so do you think it was your work ethic that got you through that time?
I honestly think it was, there was part ignorance of, very much of being an opera singer is, obviously, you know, you have a voice and you have a gift for music, but a lot of it is of that type of preparation in every musician's life is following orders. And I mean that in the best of ways, because we are, without the instruction that we all receive as musicians, we can't be musicians. And so we are dependent on so many senior musicians who give us their knowledge and their skills. And I feel I had the best of that. I had this marvelous voice teacher. I worked with incredible pianists, Bill Glazier, Martin Katz. When I was at the Manus College of Music, I often had as an instructor, one of our instructors was Murray Pariah. And Murray was a great friend then, and he used to say, come on and we'll read through some Schubert songs. Mm. So, I mean, that was pretty special. And okay. I think much of what we do, even in our future, is following orders, following the advice of people we trust. And I had the best in that regard. I had the best manager, Matthew Epstein. I worked with marvelous conductors. I worked with Lenny Bernstein, actually taught me the last song of the Mahler Fourth as I auditioned for him. And it was just, you know, it was kind of Cinderella in many regards. But you do work hard. As I'm able to look back on the years, I see there was a lot more ambition and aggression in there than I probably admit to. Mm-hmm. And it takes hours and hours and hours, and I'm not a fast learner, and you go over everything. But that's kind of what it was about. And I was able to start at the Met in a very gentle fashion, being led along by the great teachers, Alberto Masiello, Walter Tausig, Jan Baer, all these amazing maestri. And it was I learned, and we sat in every time we were singing, we were there for the whole rehearsal. So I was in rehearsal rooms with Tebaldi and Nielsen and Corelli and just listening to this magic around me.
Absorbing all of this incredible input from so many great masters, I'm wondering, first of all, just from a stage direction standpoint, each of your characters must be an amalgam of the various inputs of various directors over time, such that probably every character you play is slightly schizophrenic at this point, I would imagine. And so what happens then in performance? Is there a conscious forgetting everything and being in the moment, or is it really that painstaking? Are there that many things going on in your head as the performance is progressing?
Well, as a child, I spent every summer with my grandfather in Saratoga, and we went to the races all the time, and we watched the horses train in the morning, and there was a famous man who announced the horses as they were on the track, when the horses are on the track, and he would know every horse, every color, every owner as the horses were running, and then it was a wipeout till the next race. He completely put one out and put the other in. And I think that's what I did, because the theory behind it was, A, that same thing of being a dutiful Catholic schoolgirl and following orders, but B, I felt even if their ideas are different, these are great directors, and by trying to do what they want me to do, I will learn more than by insisting upon what I really believe is the essence. Mm-hmm. And that really worked for me. Yeah. I mean, it was, Giorgio Strehler was completely different from some of the other, with Sir Peter Hall, from Jean-Pierre Ponelle. They were very different, and I learned more by going along with them than really trying to stick to one interpretation. And that's the magic of opera, is yes, we do the same music over and over and over, but every circumstance is different. The house is different. The cast is different. The costumes are different. The conductor is different. And that sets a completely different tone, mm-hmm. and especially in an opera like The Marriage of Figaro, which is so interesting and is dependent so much on an ensemble atmosphere. Mm-hmm.
You've done such great new music too. I mean, my gosh, Dead Man Walking and of course the Richard Daniel Poor pieces. And what was it like, I have to ask, speaking of great directors, what was working with Gary Marshall like?
Oh, Gary Marshall is probably one of the dearest human beings that God ever put on the earth. And he is very much a reflection of many of his movies. There's always sort of positive and humor. I mean, you felt at the end of the day that you had gone to a marvelous show. He has mm-hmm. such wonderful humor and he clearly loves people, plus he knows what he's doing in every corner of his eye. I adored it. I adored every minute of being with him, and he puts you right at ease, and the team that he has with him are some of the nicest people you ever want to see. He's a very magic person. And plus his wife is a terrific opera fan. She grew up in Cincinnati, and so she started with opera at the Zoo, and so I think she's possibly taken him, but maybe possibly dragged him to quite a bit more opera than he might have cared for. Great baseball fan, which I always was. I was a great baseball fan as a kid, so I adored it. I just loved it.
Flicka, even with your extensive career, you've raised a family. Do you have your own kids study music?
No, they don't. My daughter Jen has a terrific voice, and she even made a demo and was going to go further. She made a demo in L.A., and at that moment she found out blissfully that she was having a baby, so it didn't come to pass, and now she is steeped into motherhood as there's no way else to be, and it's not a chance right now, but I think someday she might go back to it. She has a wonderful voice, a very clear, you know, more of a pop voice, mm-hmm. and loves it, just loves it. And she's a psychologist, which also has come in handy for dealing with her mother. And now this grandparent bit is the best time I've had in my life. Really, I'm so in love with these two little grandchildren, and I also have wonderful step-grandchildren that I've known, five of them since the day they were born. And to see your child, though, be a mother is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And I just love it. I go every month to see them because I don't want to miss one thing. And my daughter is just so, I mean, her life is chaos, but she's so happy. She is so blessedly happy. So I took them everywhere, my girls, until Sirius School, which was first grade. I even moved them around in kindergarten. And then I moved pretty much back to New York as much as I could. Mm-hmm. And I had to go away from time to time, but it was mainly in the summer when they could come. As they got older and didn't want to come so much, that was hard on me because I still had to, you know, keep going and keep working. Mm-hmm. And I hated being away, and I really believe that some of this time I'm having with my grandchildren now is, I'm getting it back, which is so lucky. I'm getting the time that I've missed with my girls. There was one year when I sang Pelias at La Scala with Claudio, and I flew back for 3 days because it was my older daughter's first communion, and then they did a reprisal 2 years later, and I flew back again for Lisa's first communion, and I remember the management saying, well, how many children do you have? And, you know, how are we going to do this? And those things were hard. I can't deny it. I used to look at my calendar and think, you know, in 3 days I have to go, in 10 days I have to go, 9 days. And I couldn't even look at the calendar and packed when I was asleep. And, you know, it was hard. I hated being away.
Well, your time management didn't stand in the way of your Pelias being the absolutely most legendary performance that we know.
Thank you. So glad to talk to you all. Thank you.
Now, I want to know from Nana Flicka whether you have any rules about practicing or things that you'd pass on to some of our young voice students. I know that it's very hard. You can't be like us pianists, you know, slaving away singing for 8 hours. So how do you handle the time? How do you manage that?
Well, I'll tell you, it's something, you know, I just did 2 master classes down at the University of North Carolina, and there are 3 things I would love to pass on. First of all, that when you do extensive work, you know, like working on coloratura passages, which takes nothing more than precision and time, lots and lots and lots and lots of time, and you don't necessarily get the payoff 3 days later. Mm-hmm. You can often, with a voice, get the payoff a month later. All the work you've put in will not show up for a while because it's, you know, you're incorporating it so much into a physicality and your mentality that it's always worth it to put in the time. Now, not to tire the voice, but I find that I practice in half-hour segments now. Now, mm-hmm. I've come to this in the last 10 years, so let me tell you, it's a little too late. But you put in half an hour, maybe 4 times a day. So you're actually working 2 hours on your voice, and the thing you're trying to do is slim it down all the time. Slim, slim, slim. Make sure that there's air behind it and all the things your teachers tell you. But you have to do it. You can't, you know, we're unusual because, you know, you can find a young singer at 18 who has a fabulous voice, like me, doesn't know who Mozart is, doesn't know where middle C is. And in a month, if they have an ear and a voice, you can teach them to sing an aria, and they can mm-hmm. sing it.
Yeah.
You couldn't begin to do that with any other instrument. And so it's an advantage in that we have a great sort of, you know, an advantage. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we don't know the value of practicing a scale 5,000 times. And mm-hmm. in the old school of singing, they did that. They mm-hmm. had books and books and books of vocal exercises. And those are the things that pay off, especially in your 30s and 40s, when you get singing sometimes too much and you're tired and you're not thinking. And that's when habits creep in, because you got to get out there and do it. Mm-hmm. But if you have that firm foundation, it just makes the rest easier. The other last piece of advice is based on a painting that was always by the piano of a great teacher that I worked with named Jani Strasse, who is Hungarian. Mm-hmm. And it was a picture of some poodles, three poodles who were sort of sitting up. And I said, Jani, why do you have that picture there? And he said, my darling, those pictures are your poodles, and your voice is your poodles. If you are good to your poodles, they do tricks. If you are bad to your poodles, they bite you. And it's really true. You have to be good to your voice, and you have to be good to your mind. Mm-hmm. Singers tend to really be very harsh with themselves. It's not a perfect instrument. To expect it to perform perfectly is never going to happen. And mean what you say. That's the last thing. Mean what you sing about. And all of a sudden, sometimes a vocal trick or a vocal achievement that you've been looking for 3 years will appear, because it was written into the music. It was conceived of by Debussy or Massenet or Mozart. But definitely be good to your poodles.
That's gold. That's absolute gold. Flicka, would you please do us the honor of introducing our next young performers?
Oh, yes, I am thrilled. And I work a lot with young singers in the Bay Area. I volunteer in a school. My students are really kind of up to the fifth grade. But
yes,
you know what?
I've read about it, but why don't we get on tape, talk about the school and mention it by name, because we should really get the word out.
Well, this is called St. Martin de Porres, and it's a Catholic school in West Oakland, and it's K through 8, and it's mainly low-income families. And a couple of years ago, with the help of a lot of people, we started a little music program there, and we now have two choirs, and of all things, violin lessons, because even in kindergarten, because it's very important for a lot of kids to hold something very fragile and have to be careful of it and feel that they are the caregiver for this fragile instrument. And you can't believe how much they actually can do if you just believe they can do it. Mm-hmm. And so the program is still going, and it's through the kindness of wonderful teachers who love our kids, and I go and just help them and, you know, get the instruments out. I've been away a lot more this year because of my granddaughters, but it's mm-hmm. it's still going. And the other great organization is called YMP, Young Musicians Program. It's existed for 45 years. It's under the umbrella of Berkeley, Cal Berkeley, but it's run by this magician, Daisy Newman. And it's children 10 to 18 from low-income families, and they have a kind of a triangle of what they need to do as musicians. They need to have, they get their free lessons, they get private lessons, an intensive summer program. They have to be good citizens, they have to have a 3.2 average, and they have to behave. And at 18... this wonderful musician here, Jim Meredith, takes them around to all the universities and music schools. And right now there are 10 kids who are in major universities, University of Michigan, Juilliard, Manhattan, School of Music, Berkeley. It's jazz as well. The kids have to be in choir and play in the orchestra. They can pick their instrument. And now, 2 years ago, they sing in the choir, and then they walk down into the orchestra and pick up their instruments and play. So they're a singing orchestra now. Wow. And the success is extraordinary. 100% of the kids go to college afterwards. So I've done fundraising for them and helped many of our kids from St. Martin de Porres have gone into the program, and we have one extraordinary voice. She sounds like De Los Angeles, and she's 15, and she got a full scholarship to a good high school, and it's changing their lives and the parents' lives. They're so proud of the kids.
Yeah.
So I've just adored it. So any program that puts music in the hands of everybody that deserves it, I applaud with all my heart. Mm-hmm. I think it's so important. We had recently visiting out here Dudamel's teacher, Abrieux. He said, for many people, music is the only way they will actually experience human dignity. And it's true. It's true with what mm-hmm. goes on in our country right now with that word poverty and struggle. It's mm-hmm. such a struggle. So anything
it's
that
very
does
good.
Things
it's
for
very
kids,
good to hear Daisy Newman's. It's great to hear Daisy Newman's name again. We actually did a big piece on her and the program. Maybe it was actually when we did a show at Berkeley several years ago.
Oh, really?
Ago. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's very very good to hear that going on. And,
you know, one other thing you might not know about is that Beach Blanket Babylon, which you know.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, it started. Joe Schumann started. It's a competition for an actor, a singer, and a dancer. And they get $30,000, and they compete every year from all the high schools in the Bay Area. And she does that every year now. There's just more and more coming to light, which is fantastic.
Great things. Flicka, would you do us the honor of introducing our next young performers?
I would be delighted to introduce your performers and just wish that I could hear them, and I send them all my best wishes and support. And now to perform Geistliches Wiegenlied by Johannes Brahms, please welcome from just outside Columbus, Ohio, the members of the Mittelpunkt Duo. They are 18-year-old violist Eva Kennedy and my fellow mezzo-soprano, 17-year-old Michaela Cipriani.
Thanks for downloading this week's From the Top podcast. If you liked what you heard, head over to our website, fromthetop.org, where you can listen to every show in its entirety. I'm Christopher O'Reilly. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again next week.